Hey, it's Paul. I've been reading Moby Dick to my kids as a bedtime story, but I haven't been reading every chapter. A lot of the chapters are very discursive. Moby Dick is really a fascinating novel. It has very different styles of chapters, very different types of chapters interleaved. It's almost like Melville wrote the book three or four times. Once as a play, once as a story, once as a series of sort of personal memories of sea voyages, and once as some kind of like a scholarly dissertation on the history and nature of whales and their biology and zoology and their imagery and art and all that. And then maybe you can imagine that he chopped all these up and interleaved them. For the kids, I'm skipping some of the chapters. Like, there's a chapter called Cetology, which is a long, it's funny, but it's long and rambling, discursive chapter about how to categorize all the different types of whales in like a zoological framework. And some of the wording and language is funny, and some puns and allusions and whatnot. But I don't th that's not really going to entertain the kids, and they're not going to get what's going on in that chapter. So I'm going to read to you four chapters, chapters 28 through 31, because I think they form a nice little story arc. And what they really do is they introduce some characters. They introduce Ahab, they introduce Stubb, and they introduce Flask. And those are about the only characters you hear from. And then, of course, there's the point of view of the narrator, Ishmael. I'm going to voice them a little bit. So Stubb is not actually short. Flask is the one who's short, but I'm going to give Stubb a voice that is sort of based on my impression of Sean Astin doing Sam Gamgee in the Lord of the Rings movies. And then Ahab, I kind of imagine Patrick Stewart's Ahab. He actually did a movie version of Ahab for one of the cable channels a few years ago, and you can find it on DVD, I think. And it's pretty good, actually. And then Flask, he doesn't say much, but I was imagining, because Flask is so described as such a short character, I was imagining him as a Gimli in the Lord of the Rings movies. And then there's the merman, and I don't know how to. I'm doing the merman as for someone with a like who has lost all his teeth and doesn't have dentures and speaks like this and kind of gums. He has no teeth. Anyway, toothless. I don't know, hag kind of character. Is that sexist? I don't know. Anyway. But I'm doing my best here. So I'm going to read it to you the way I read it to the kids. And the kids really enjoyed this. And I've read Moby Dick before. This will be my, like, maybe third time reading it, I think. But somehow rereading it out loud is making it come to life in a way that it never did to just read it to myself. And in particular, a lot of these chapters, I'm hearing the music of the language that Melville was a true genius, and he was writing in several different styles, and he was really obsessed with his sentences, with their alliteration, with wordplay, with the way his sentences sounded, with the way the mood of the sentences, with the way they tilted this way and that, and then his characters are really fantastic. So Ahab says almost nothing in this. He has only a few lines, but they convey a lot. So he chews out Stubb for complaining that his whalebone leg is making a racket on the decks as he paces back and forth while the sailors underneath are trying to sleep right under the deck in their hammocks. And Ahab just goes off on him. And there's this big contrast between how Ishmael describes Ahab as so stable with his leg like stuck down in a hole in the deck and hanging onto a shroud, a sail. that he is upright and rigid and very stable up on the deck. And yet, everything he says and does in his moodiness and lashing out at Stubb like this, he seems completely unstable. And then in a next little soliloquy scene, we see Ahab trying to smoke his pipe and getting frustrated with it that it's not soothing him, and he throws his pipe overboard. And so really, you know, for the rest of the book, he's going to be going through nicotine withdrawal, and then you can also imagine that this is just Melville's way of showing just how impulsive Ahab is, how impulsive his character is. And then there's a really funny chapter, which I think is just as memorable and funny as anything out of Joyce, memorably weird, and seems very Shakespearean too, where you have a soliloquy by Stubb, who's talking to Flask. He's talking about his dream, and it's just surreal. He imagines Ahab as this pyramid, this like the base of a pyramid. Ahab is elevated way up on this sculptural platform, and Stubb is angry at him and he's kicking it, but he's conveying that Ahab is so far above him and so stable and, you know, like a rock, like a stone, that he can't even get his attention. And the mermaid also shows Stubb his rear end, and, you know, there are harpoons sticking out of his rear end with the points out, so that you wouldn't want to kick his rear end, you'd stab yourself in the foot. So he's getting at the, you know, kicking someone like Ahab, you're only going to hurt yourself. Anyway, I hope that you get something out of this in some kind of a feel for just how much characterization and how much fun and how much humor Melville put into this. It's really amazing me and moving me and touching me. And we're quite a bit further along in the book now, but I'm going back to read these chapters because I think they fit together really nicely as sort of a short excerpt. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it. Thanks. Chapter 28, Ahab. For several days after leaving Nantucket, nothing above hatches was seen of Captain Ahab. The mates regularly relieved each other at the watches, and for aught that could be seen to the contrary, they seemed to be the only commanders of the ship, only they sometimes issued from the cabin with orders so sudden and peremptory that after all it was plain they but commanded vicariously. Yes, their supreme lord and dictator was there, though hitherto unseen by any eyes not permitted to penetrate into the now sacred retreat of the cabin. Every time I ascended to the deck from my watches below, I instantly gazed aft to mark if any strange face were visible, for my first vague disquietude touching the unknown captain, now in the seclusion of the sea, became almost a perturbation. This was strangely heightened at times by the ragged Elijah's diabolical incoherences uninvitedly recurring to me with a subtle energy I could not have before conceived of. But poorly could I withstand them, much as in other moods I was almost ready to smile at the solemn whimsicalities of that outlandish prophet of the wharves. But whatever it was of apprehensiveness or uneasiness, to call it so, which I felt, yet whenever I came to look about me in the ship, it seemed against all warranty to cherish such emotions. For though the harpooners with the great body of the crew were a far more barbaric, heathenish, and motley set than any of the tame merchant ship companies which my previous experiences had made me acquainted with, still I ascribed this, and rightly ascribed it, to the fierce uniqueness of the very nature of that wild Scandinavian vocation in which I had so abandonedly embarked. But it was especially the aspect of the three chief officers of the ship, the mates, which was most forcibly calculated to allay these colorless misgivings, and induce confidence and cheerfulness in every presentiment of the voyage. Three better, more likely sea officers and men, each in his own different way, could not readily be found, and they were every one of them Americans, a Nantucketer, a Vineyarder, a Cape Man. Now, it being Christmas when the ship shot out from her harbor, for a space we had biting polar weather, though all the time running away from it to the southward, and by every degree and minute of latitude which we sailed, gradually leaving that merciless winter and all its intolerable weather behind us. It was one of those lowering, but still gray and gloomy enough mornings of the transition, when with a fair wind the ship was rushing through the water with a vindictive sort of leaping and melancholy rapidity, that as I mounted to the deck at the call of the forenoon watch, so soon as I leveled my glance towards the taffrail, foreboding shivers ran over me. Reality outran apprehension. Captain Ahab stood upon his quarterdeck. There seemed no sign of common bodily illness about him, nor of the recovery from any. He looked like a man cut away from the stake when the fire has overrunningly wasted all the limbs without consuming them or taking away one particle from their compacted, aged robustness. His whole high, broad form seemed made of solid bronze and shaped in an unalterable mold like Selene's cast Perseus. Threading its way out from among his gray hairs and continuing right down one side of his tawny, scorched face and neck till it disappeared in his clothing, you saw a slender, rod-like mark, lividly whitish. It resembled that perpendicular seam sometimes made in the straight, lofty trunk of a great tree, when the upper lightning tearingly darts down it, and without wrenching a single twig, peels and grooves out the bark from top to bottom, ere running off into the soil, leaving the tree still greenly alive, but branded. Whether that mark was born with him, or whether it was the scar left by some desperate wound, no one could certainly say. By some tacit consent, throughout the voyage, little or no allusion was made to it, especially by the mates. But once Tashtego Sr., an old gay-head Indian among the crew, superstitiously asserted that not till he was full 40 years old did Ahab become that way branded. And then it came upon him, not in the fury of any mortal fray, but in an elemental strife at sea. Yet this wild hint seemed inferentially negatived by what a gray Manx man insinuated, an old sepulchral man who, having never before sailed out of Nantucket, had never ere this laid eye upon wild Ahab. Nevertheless, the old sea traditions, the immemorial credulities, popularly invested this old Manx man with preternatural powers of discernment, so that no white sailor seriously contradicted him when he said that if ever Captain Ahab should be tranquilly laid out, which might hardly come to pass, so he muttered, then whoever should do that last office for the dead would find a birthmark on him from crown to sole. So powerfully did the whole grim aspect of Ahab affect me, and the livid brand which streaked it, that for the first few moments I hardly noted that not a little of this overbearing grimness was owing to the barbaric white leg upon which he partly stood. It had previously come to me that this ivory leg had at sea been fashioned from the polished bone of the sperm whale's jaw. "Aye, he was dismasted off Japan," said the old gay-head Indian once. "But like his dismasted craft, he shipped another mast without coming home for it. He has a quiver of him." I was struck with the singular posture he maintained. Upon each side of the Pequod's quarter-deck, and pretty close to the mizzen shrouds, there was an auger hole, bored about half an inch or so into the plank. His bone leg steadied in that hole, one arm elevated and holding by a shroud, Captain Ahab stood erect, looking straight out beyond the ship's ever-pitching prow. There was an infinity of firmest fortitude, a determinate, unsurrenderable willfulness in the fixed and fearless forward dedication of that glance. Not a word he spoke, nor did his officers say aught to him, though by all their minutest gestures and expressions they plainly showed the uneasy, if not painful, consciousness of being under a troubled master eye. And not only that, but moody, stricken Ahab stood before them with a crucifixion in his face, in all the nameless, regal, overbearing dignity of some mighty woe. Erelong, from his first visit in the air, he withdrew into his cabin, but after that evening, he was every day visible to the crew, either standing in his pivot hole or seated upon an ivory stool he had, or heavily walking the deck. As the sky grew less gloomy, indeed began to grow a little genial, he became still less and less a recluse, as if when the ship had sailed from home, nothing but the dead wintry bleakness of the sea had then kept him so secluded. And by it came to pass that he was almost continually in the air, but as yet for all that he said or perceptibly did, on the at last sunny deck he seemed as unnecessary there as another mast. But the Pequod was only making a passage now, not regularly cruising. Nearly all whaling preparatives needing supervision the mates were fully competent to, so that there was little or nothing out of himself to employ or excite Ahab now, and thus chase away for that one interval the clouds that layer upon layer were piled upon his brow, as ever all clouds choose the loftiest peaks to pile themselves on. Nevertheless, ere long the warm warbling persuasiveness of the pleasant holiday weather we came to seemed gradually to charm him from his mood, for as when the red-cheeked dancing girls, April and May, trip home to the wintry misanthropic woods, even the barest, ruggedest, most thunder-cloven old oak will at least send forth some few green sprouts to welcome such glad-hearted visitants, so Ahab did, in the end, a little respond to the playful allurings of that girlish air. More than once did he put forth the faint blossom of a look, which in any other man would have soon flowered out in a smile. Chapter 29. Enter Ahab. To him, Stubb. Some days elapsed, and ice and icebergs all astern, the Pequod now went rolling through the bright Quito spring, which at sea almost perpetually reigns in the threshold of the eternal August of the tropic. The warmly cool, clear, ringing, perfumed, overflowing, redundant days were as crystal goblets of Persian sherbet, heaped up, flaked up, with rosewater snow. The starred and stately nights seemed haughty dames in jeweled velvets, nursing at home in lonely pride the memory of their absent conquering earls, the golden-helmeted sons. For sleeping man, 'twas hard to choose between such winsome days and such seducing nights. But all the witcheries of that unwaning weather did not merely lend new spells and potencies to the outward world. Inward they turned upon the soul, especially when the still mild hours of eve came on. Then memory shot her crystals as the clear ice most forms of noiseless twilights. And all these subtle agencies, more and more they wrought on Ahab's texture. Old age is always wakeful, as if the longer linked with life, the less man has to do with aught that looks like death. Among sea commanders, the old graybeards will oftenest leave their berths to visit the night-cloaked deck. It was so with Ahab, only that now, of late, he seemed so much to live in the open air, that truly speaking his visits were more to the cabin than from the cabin to the planks. "It feels like going down into one's tomb," he would mutter to himself, "for an old captain like me to be descending this narrow scuttle to go to my grave-dug berth." So almost every 24 hours, when the watches of the night were set and the band on deck sentineled the slumbers of the band below, and when, if a rope was to be hauled upon the forecastle, the sailors flung it not rudely down as by day, but with some cautiousness dropped it to its place, for fear of disturbing their slumbering shipmates, when this sort of steady quietude would begin to prevail, habitually, the silent steersman would watch the cabin scuttle, and ere long the old man would emerge, gripping at the iron banister to help his crippled way. Some considerating touch of humanity was in him, for at times like these he usually abstained from patrolling the quarter-deck, because to his wearied mates seeking repose within 6 inches of his ivory heel, such would have been the reverberating crack and din of that bony step that their dreams would have been of the crunching teeth of sharks. But once the mood was on him too deep for common regardings, and as with heavy, lumber-like pace he was measuring the ship from taffrail to mainmast, Stubb, the odd second mate, came up from below, and with a certain unassured, deprecating humorousness, hinted that if Captain Ahab was pleased to walk the planks, then no one could say nay, but there might be some way of muffling the noise, hinting something indistinctly and hesitatingly about a globe of toe, and the insertion into it of the ivory heel. Ah, Stubb, thou didst not know Ahab then.
Am I a cannonball, Stubb, said Ahab, that thou wouldst wad me in that fashion? But go thy ways, I had forgot. Blow to thy nightly grave, where such as ye sleep between shrouds, to use ye to the filling one at last. Down, dog, and kennel!
Staring at the unforeseen concluding exclamation of the so suddenly scornful old man, Stubb was speechless a moment, then said excitedly,
I am not used to be spoken to that way, sir. I do but less than half like it, sir.
Avast!
Gritted Ahab between his set teeth, and violently moving away, as if to avoid some passionate temptation.
No, sir, not yet, said Stubb, emboldened. I will not tamely be called a dog, sir.
Then be called 10 times a donkey, and a mule, and an ass, and be gone, or I'll clear the world of thee.
As he said this, Ahab advanced upon him with such overbearing terrors in his aspect that Stubb involuntarily retreated.
I was never served so before without giving a hard blow for it, muttered Stubb, as he found himself descending the cabin scuttle. It's very queer. Stop, Stubb, somehow, now, I don't well know whether to go back and strike him, or what's that, down here on my knees and pray for him. Yes, that was the thought coming up in me, but it would be the first time I ever did pray. It's queer, very queer, and he's queer, too, aye. Take him fore and aft, he's about the queerest old man Stubb ever sailed with. How he flashed at me, his eyes like powder pans. Is he mad? Anyway, there's something on his mind, as sure as there must be something on a deck when it cracks. He ain't in his bed now either, more than 3 hours out of the 24, and he don't sleep then. Didn't that doughboy, the steward, tell me that of a morning he always finds the old man's hammock clothes all rumpled and tumbled, and the sheets down at the foot, and the frightful coverlid almost tied into knots, and the pillow a sort of frightful hot, as though a baked brick had been on it. A hot old man! I guess he's got what some folks ashore call a conscience. It's kind of tick-dolly now, as they say, worse nor a toothache. Well, I don't know what it is, but the Lord keep me from catching it. He's full of riddles. I wonder what he goes into the afterhold for every night, as Doughboy tells me he suspects. What's that for, I should like to know? Who made appointments with him in the hold? Ain't that queer now? But there's no telling, it's the old game. Here goes for a snooze. Damn me, it's worth a fellow's while to be born into the world, if only to fall right asleep. And now that I think about it, that's about the first thing babies do, and that's sort of queer, too. Damn me, but all things are queer, come to think of 'em. But that's against my principles. Think not is my 11th commandment, and sleep, when you can, is my 12th. So here goes again. But how's that? Didn't he call me a dog? Blazes, he called me 10 times a donkey and piled a lot of jackasses on top of that. He might as well have kicked me and done with it. Maybe he did kick me and I didn't observe it. I was so taken all aback with his brow somehow. It flashed like a bleached bone. What the devil's the matter with me? I don't stand right on my legs. Coming afoul of that old man has a sort of turned me wrong side out. By the Lord, I must have been dreaming, though. How? But the only way's to stash it. So here goes to hammock again, and in the morning I'll see how this plaguey juggling thinks over by daylight.
Chapter 30. The Pipe. When Stubb had departed, Ahab stood for a while leaning over the bulwarks, and then, as had been usual with him of late, calling a sailor of the watch, he sent him below for his ivory stool and also his pipe. Lighting the pipe at the binnacle lamp and planting the stool on the weather side of the deck, he sat and smoked. In old Norse times, the thrones of the sea-loving Danish kings were fabricated, saith tradition, of the tusks of the narwhal. How could one look at Ahab, then, seated on that tripod of bones, without bethinking him of the royalty it symbolized? for a Khan of the Plank, and a King of the Sea, and a great Lord of Leviathans was Ahab. Some moments passed, during which the thick vapor came from his mouth in quick and constant puffs, which blew back again into his face. "How now?" he soliloquized at last, withdrawing the tube. "This smoking no longer soothes. Oh, my pipe, hard it must go with me if thy charm be gone. Here have I been unconsciously toiling, not pleasuring. Aye, and ignorantly smoking to windward all the while, to windward, and with such nervous whiffs as if, like the dying whale, my final jets were the strongest and fullest of trouble. What business have I with this pipe? This thing that is meant for sereneness, to send up mild white vapors among mild white hairs, not among torn iron-gray locks like mine. I'll smoke no more." He tossed the still-lighted pipe into the sea. The fire hissed in the waves. The same instant, the ship shot by the bubble the sinking pipe made. With slouched hat, Ahab lurchingly paced the planks. Chapter 31. Queen Mab. Next morning, Stubb accosted Flask.
"Such a queer dream, King Post, I never had. You know the old man's ivory leg? Well, I dreamed he kicked me with it. And when I tried to kick back, upon my soul, my little man, I kicked my leg right off. And then, presto! Ahab seemed a pyramid, and I, like a blazing fool, kept kicking at it. But what was still more curious, Flask, you know how curious all dreams are. Through all this rage that I was in, I somehow seemed to be thinking to myself that after all, it was not much of an insult, that kick from Ahab. Why, thinks I, what's the row? It's not a real leg, only a false leg. And there's a mighty difference between a living thump and a dead thump. That's what makes a blow from the hand, Flask, 50 times more savage to bear than a blow from a cane. The living member, that makes the living insult, my little man. And thinks I to myself, all the while mine, while I was stubbing my silly toes against that cursed pyramid. So confoundingly contradictory was it all the while, I say, I was thinking to myself, what's his leg now but a cane? A whalebone cane, yes, thinks I. It was only a playful cudgeling. In fact, only a whaleboning that he gave me, not a base kick. Besides, thinks I, look at it once. Why, the end of it, the foot part, what a small sort of end it is. Whereas, if a broad-footed farmer kicked me, there's a devilish broad insult. But this insult is whittled down to a point only. But now comes the greatest joke of the dream, Flask. While I was battering away at the pyramid, a sort of badger-haired old merman with a hump on his back takes me by the shoulders and slews me around.
"What are you about?" says he.
"Slid, man, but I was frightened. Such a fizz. But somehow next moment I was over the fright. What am I about?" says I at last. "And what business is that of yours, I should like to know, Mr. Humpback? Do you want a kick?"
By the Lord, Flask, I had no sooner said that than he turned round his stern to me, bent over, and dragging up a lot of seaweed he had for a clout. What do you think I saw? Why, thunder alive, man, his stern was stuck full of marlin spikes with the points out. Says I on second thoughts, "Well, I guess I won't kick you, old fellow."
"Why, Stubb,"
says he,
"why, Stubb,"
and kept muttering it all the time, a sort of eating of his own gums like a chimney hag, seeing he wasn't going to stop saying over his
"Why, Stubb? Why, Stubb?"
I thought I might as well fall to kicking the pyramid again. But I had only just lifted my foot for it when he roared out,
"Stop that kicking!"
"Halloa," says I. "What's the matter now, old fella?"
"Looky here," says he. "Let's argue the insult. Captain Ahab kicked you, didn't he?"
"Yes, he did," says I. "Right here it was."
"Very good," says he. "He used his ivory leg, didn't he?"
"Yes, he did," says I.
"Well then," says he, "why, Stubb, what have you to complain of? Didn't he kick with right good will? It wasn't a common pitch pine leg he kicked with, was it? No, you were kicked by a great man, and with a beautiful ivory leg, Stubb. It's an honor. I consider it an honor. Listen, wise Stub, in old England, the greatest lords think it great glory to be slapped by a queen, and made garter knights of. But be your boast, Stub, that you were kicked by old Ahab and made a wise man of. Remember what I say, be kicked by him, account his kicks honors, and on no account kick back. For you can't help yourself, wise Stub, don't you see that pyramid?
With that, he all of a sudden seemed somehow in some queer fashion to swim off into the air. I snored, rolled over, and there I was in my hammock. Now what do you think of that dream, Flask?
I don't know. It seems sort of foolish to me, though.
Maybe, maybe, but it's made a wise man of me, Flask. Do you see Ahab standing there, sideways, looking over the stern? Well, the best thing you can do, Flask, is to let that old man alone. Never speak quick to him, whatever he says. Halloo! What's that he shouts? Hark!
Masthead there! Look sharp, all of ye! There are whales hereabouts. If ye see a white one, split your lungs for him.
What do you think of that now, Flask? Ain't there a small drop of something queer about that, eh? A white whale. Did ye mark that, man? Look ye, there's something special in the wind. Stand by for it, Flask. Ahab has that that's bloody on his mind. But, Mum, he comes this way.